defeat every step of the way since we rode forth from Deepwood Mott. It makes me wonder whose side you're on." A flush crept up Massey's neck. "I will not stay here to be insulted." He wrenched his damp cloak down from the wall, so hard that Asher heard it tear. Then stalked past Hope and through the door. A blast of cold air blew through the hall, raising ashes from the fire trench and fanning its flames a little brighter. "Broken quick as that," thought Asher. "My champion is made of suet." Even so, Sir Justin was one of the few who might object should the Queen's men try to burn her. So she rose to her feet, donned her own cloak, and followed him out into the blizzard. She was lost before she had gone 10 yards. Asher could see the beacon fire burning atop the watchtower, the faint orange glow floating in the air. Elsewise, the village was gone. She was alone in a white world of snow and silence, ploughing through snowdrifts as high as her thighs. "Justin!" she called. There was no answer. Somewhere to her left, she heard a horse whicker.
"The poor thing sounds frightened. Perhaps he knows that he's to be tomorrow's supper."
Asher pulled her cloak about her tightly. She blundered back onto the village green, unknowing. The pinewood stakes still stood, charred and scorched, but not burnt through. The chains about the dead had cooled by now, she saw, but still held the corpses fast in their iron embrace. A raven was perched atop one, pulling at the tatters of burned flesh that clung to its blackened skull. The blowing snow had covered the ashes at the base of the pyre, and crept up the dead man's leg as far as his ankle.
"The old gods mean to bury him," Asher thought. "This was no work of theirs."
"Take a good long gander, cunt," the deep voice of Clayton Sugg said behind her. "You look just as pretty once you're roasted. Tell me, can squids scream?"
"God of my fathers, if you can hear me in your watery halls beneath the waves, grant me just one small throwing axe."
The drowned god did not answer. He seldom did. That was the trouble with gods.
"Have you seen Sir Justin?"
"That prancing fool. What do you want with him, cunt? If it's a fuck you need, I'm more man than Massey."
"Cunt again."
It was odd how men like Suggs used that word to demean women, when it was the only part of a woman they valued. And Suggs was worse than middle little.
"When he says the word, he means it. Your king gels men for rape," she reminded him.
Sir Clayton chuckled. "The king's half blind from staring into fires. But have no fear, cunt. I'll not rape you. I'd need to kill you after, and I'd sooner see you burn."
"There's that horse again. Do you hear that?"
"Hear what?"
"A horse. No, horses. More than one."
She turned her head, listening. The snow did queer things to sound. It was hard to know which direction it had come from.
"Is this some squid game? I don't hear—"
Sugg scowled.
"Bloody hell! Riders!"
He fumbled at his sword belt, his hands clumsy in their fur and leather gloves, and finally succeeded in ripping his long sword from its scabbard. By then the riders were upon them. They emerged from the storm like a troop of wraiths, big men on small horses, made even bigger by the bulky furs they wore. Swords rode on their hips, singing their soft steel song as they rattled in their scabbards. Asher saw a battle axe strapped to one man's saddle, a war hammer on another's back. Shields they bore as well, but so obscured by snow and ice that the arms upon them could not be read. For all her layers of wool and fur and boiled leather, Asher felt naked standing there.
"A horn," she thought. "I need a horn to rouse the camp."
"Run, you stupid cunt," Sir Clayton shouted. "Run, warn the king. Lord Bolton is upon us." A brute he might have been, but Suggs did not want for courage. Sword in hand, he strode through the snow, putting himself between the riders and the king's tower, its beacon glimmering behind him like the orange eye of some strange god. "Who goes there? Halt! Halt!" The lead rider reined up before him. Behind were others, perhaps as many as a score. Asher had no time to count them. Hundreds more might be out there in the storm, coming hard upon their heels. Roose Bolton's entire host might be descending on them, hidden by darkness and swirling snow. These, though,
they are too many to be scouts and too few to make a vanguard.
And two were all in black.
"Night's watch,"
she realized suddenly.
"Who are you?" she called.
"Friends," a half-familiar voice replied.
"We looked for you at Winterfell, but found only crow-food umber, beating drums and blowing horns. It took some time to find you."
The rider vaulted from his saddle, pulled back his hood, and bowed. So thick was his beard, and so crusted with ice, that for a moment Asher did not know him. Then it came.
"Triss," she said.
"My lady." Christopher Butley took a knee. "The maid is here as well. Rogan, Grimtongue, Fingers, Rook. Six of us, all those fit enough to ride. Crumb died of his wounds." "What is this?" Sir Clayton Suggs demanded.
"You're one of hers. How did you get loose of Deepwood's dungeons?"
Triss rose and brushed the snow from his knees.
"Sybil Glover was offered a handsome ransom for our freedom, and chose to accept it in the name of the king."
"What ransom?"
"Who would pay good coin for sea scum?"
"I did, sir."
The speaker came forward on his garron. He was very tall, very thin, so long-legged that it was a wonder that his feet did not drag along the ground.
"I had the need of a strong escort to see me safely to the king, and Lady Sibel had need of fewer mouths to feed."
A scarf concealed the tall man's features, but atop his head was perched the queerest hat Asher had seen since the last time she had sailed to Tyrosh, a brimless tower of some soft fabric, like three cylinders stacked one on top the other.
"I was given to understand that I might find King Stannis here. It is a most urgent that I speak with him at once."
"And who in seven stinking hells are you?" The tall man slid gracefully from his garron, removed his peculiar hat, and bowed.
"I have the honor to be Tycho Nestoris, a humble servant of the Iron Bank of Braavos."
Of all the strange things that might have come riding out of the night, the last one Asher Greyjoy would ever have expected was a Braavosi banker. It was too absurd. She had to laugh.
"King Stannis has taken the watchtower for his seat. Sir Clayton will be pleased to show you to him, I'm sure."
"That would be most kind. Time is of the essence."
The banker studied her with shrewd dark eyes.
"You are the Lady Asher of House Greyjoy, unless I am mistaken."
"I am Asher of House Greyjoy, aye. Opinions differ on whether I'm a lady."
The Braavosi smiled.
"We've brought a gift for you."
He beckoned to the men behind him.
"We had expected to find the king at Winterfell. This same blizzard has engulfed the castle, alas. Beneath its walls we found Mors Umber with a troop of raw green boys waiting for the king's coming. He gave us this."
"A girl and an old man," thought Asher,
as the two were dumped rudely in the snow before her. The girl was shivering violently, even in her furs. If she had not been so frightened, she might even have been pretty, though the tip of her nose was black with frostbite. The old man, well, no one would ever think him comely. She had seen scarecrows with more flesh. His face was a skull with skin. His hair bone-white and filthy,
and he stank. Just the sight of him filled Asher with revulsion. He raised his eyes.
"Sister, see, this time I knew you."
Asher's heart skipped a beat.
"Theon?"
His lips skinned back in what might have been a grin. Half his teeth were gone, and half of those still left him were broken and splintered.
"Theon," he repeated. "My name is Theon. You have to know your name."
Victorian. The sea was black and the moon was silver as the iron fleet swept down on the prey. They sighted her in the narrows between the Isle of Cedars and the rugged hills of the Astapori hinterlands, just as the black priest Makoro had said they would.
"Gaskari!"
Longwater Pike shouted down from the crow's nest. Victorian Greyjoy watched her sail grow larger from the forecastle. Soon he could make out her oars rising and falling, and the long white wake behind her shining in the moonlight, like a scar across the sea.
"Not a true warship," Victorian realized. "A trading galley, and a big one."
She would make a fine prize. He signaled to his captains to give chase. They would board this ship and take her. The captain of the galley had realized his peril by then. He changed course for the west, making for the Isle of Cedars, perhaps hoping to shelter in some hidden cove, or run his pursuers onto the jagged rocks along the island's northeast coast. His galley was heavy-laden, though, and the Ironborn had the wind. Grief and Iron Victory cut across the quarry's course, while Swift, Sparrowhawk, and Agile Finger Dancer swept behind her. Even then, the Gascara captain did not strike his banners. By the time Lamentation came alongside the prey, raking her larboard side and splintering her oars, both ships were so close to the haunted ruins of Gozai that they could hear the monkeys chattering as the first dawn light washed over the city's broken pyramids. Their prize was named Gascari Dawn, the galley's captain said, when he was delivered to Victorian in chains. She was out of New Gis, and was returning there by way of Yunkai, after trading at Mirin. The man spoke no decent tongue, but only a guttural Gascari, full of growls and hisses, as ugly a language as Victorian Greyjoy had ever heard. Makaro translated the captain's words into the common tongue of Westeros. The war for Mirin was won, the captain claimed. The Dragon Queen was dead, and a Gascari by the name of Hisdak rule the city now. Victorian had his tongue torn out for lying. Daenerys Targaryen was not dead, Makaro assured him. His red god, R'hllor, had shown him the queen's face in his sacred fires. The captain could not abide lies, so he had the Gascari captain bound hand and foot and thrown overboard, a sacrifice to the drowned god.
"Your red god will have his due," he promised Makaro. "But the seas are ruled by the drowned god."
"There are no gods, but R'hllor and the other, whose name may not be said."
The sorcerer priest was garbed in somber black, but for a hint of golden thread at collar, cuffs, and hem. There was no red cloth aboard the Iron Victory, but it was not meet that Makaro go about in the salt-stained rags he had been wearing when the Vole fished him from the sea. So Victorian had commanded Tom Tidewood to sew new robes for him from whatever was at hand, and had even donated some of his own tunics to the purpose. Of black and gold those were, for the arms of House Greyjoy showed a golden kraken on a black field, and the banners and sails of their ships displayed the same. The crimson and scarlet robes of the Red Priests were alien to the Ironborn, but Victorian had hoped his men might accept Makaro more easily once clad in Greyjoy colours. He hoped in vain. Clad in black from head to heel, with a mask of red and orange flames tattooed across his face, the priest appeared more sinister than ever. The crew shunned him when he walked the deck,
and men would spit if his shadow chanced to fall upon them. Even the Vole, who had fished the Red Priest from the sea, had urged Victorian to give him to the drowned god. But Macaro knew these strange shores in ways the Ironborn did not, and secrets of the dragon kind as well. "The crow's eye keeps wizards. Why shouldn't I?" His black sorcerer was more puissant than all of Urin's three, even if you threw them in a pot and boiled them down to one. The Damhair might disapprove, but Aaron and his pieties were far away. So Victorian closed his burned hand into a mighty fist and said, "Descari Dawn is no fit name for a ship of the Iron Fleet. For you, wizard, I shall rename her Red God's Wrath." His wizard bowed his head.
"As the captain says."
And the ships of the Iron Fleet numbered 54 once again. The next day a sudden squall descended on them. Macaro had predicted that as well. When the rains moved on, three ships were found to have vanished. Victorian had no way to know whether they had foundered, run aground, or been blown off course. "They know where we're going," he told his crew. "If they are still afloat, we will meet again." The Iron Captain had no time to wait for laggards, not with his bride encircled by her enemies. "The most beautiful woman in the world has urgent need of my axe." Besides, Macaro assured him that the three ships were not lost. Each night, the sorcerer priest would kindle a fire on the forecastle of the Iron Victory and stalk around the flames, chanting prayers. The firelight made his black skin shine like polished onyx, and sometimes Victorian could swear that the flames tattooed on his face were dancing too, twisting and bending, melting into one another, their colours changing with every turn of the priest's head. "The black priest is calling demons down on us," one oarsman was heard to say. When that was reported to Victorian, he had the man scourged until his back was blood from shoulders to buttocks. So when Macaro said,
"Your lost lambs will return to the flock, off the isle called Yaris,"
the captain said, "Pray that they do, priest, or you may be the next to taste the whip." The sea was blue and green, and the sun blazing down from an empty blue sky when the Iron Fleet took its second prize, in the waters north and west of Astabor. This time it was a Mirish cog, named Dove, on her way to Yunkai by way of New Gis, with a cargo of carpets, sweet green wines, and Mirish lace. Her captain owned a Mirish eye that made far-off things look close. Two glass lenses in a series of brass tubes, cunningly wrought, so that each section slid into the next, until the eye was no longer than a dirk. Victorian claimed that treasure for himself. The cog he renamed Shrike. Her crew would be kept for ransom, the captain decreed. They were neither slaves nor slavers, but free mermen and seasoned sailors. Such men were worth good coin. Sailing out of Mir, the Dove brought them no fresh news of Mirin or Daenerys, only stale reports of Dothraki horsemen along the Rhoyne, the Golden Company upon the march, and other things Victorian already knew. "What do you see?" the captain asked his black priest that night, as Macaro stood before his nightfire. "What awaits us on the morrow? More rain?" It smelled like rain to him.
"Grey skies and strong winds," Macaro said. "No rain. Behind come the tigers. Ahead awaits your dragon."
"Your dragon?" Victorian liked the sound of that. "Tell me something I do not know, priest."
"The captain commands, and I obey," said Macaro.
The crew had taken to calling him the Black Flame, a name fastened on him by Stefar Stamera, who could not say Macaro. By any name, the priest had powers.
"The coastline here runs west to east," he told Victorian. When it turns north, you will come unto more hares, swift ones, with many legs.
And so it came to pass. This time the prey proved to be a pair of galleys, long and sleek and fast. Ralph the Limper was the first to sight them, but they soon outdistanced Woe and Forlorn Hope, so Victorian sent Iron Wing, Sparrowhawk, and Kraken's Kiss to run them down. He had no swifter ships than those three. The pursuit lasted the best part of the day, but in the end both galleys were boarded and taken, after brief but brutal fights. They had been running empty, Victorian learned, making for New Gis to load supplies and weapons for the Gascari legions in camp before Mirin, and bring fresh legionnaires to the war, to replace all the men who died. "Men slain in battle?" asked Victorian. The crews of the galleys denied it. The deaths were from a bloody flux. The Pale Mare, they called it, and like the captain of the Gascari Dawn, the captains of the galleys repeated the lie that Daenerys Targaryen was dead.
"Give her a kiss for me, in whatever hell you find her," Victorian said.
He called for his axe and took their heads off there and then. Afterwards he put their crews to death as well, saving only the slaves chained to the oars. He broke their chains himself and told them they were now free men and would have the privilege of rowing for the Iron Fleet, an honour that every boy in the Iron Islands dreamed of growing up.
"A Dragon Queen, free slaves, and so do I," he proclaimed.
The galleys he renamed Ghost and Shade, "for I mean them to return and haunt these Yunkish men," he told the dusky woman that night after he had taken his pleasure of her. They were close now, and growing closer every day.
"We will fall upon them like a thunderbolt," he said, as he squeezed the woman's breast.
He wondered if this was how his brother Aaron felt when the drowned guard spoke to him. He could almost hear the guard's voice welling up from the depths of the sea. "You shall serve me well, my captain," the wave seemed to say. "It was for this I made you." But he would feed the Red Guard too, Makara's fire guard. The arm the priest had healed was hideous to look upon, pork crackling from elbow to fingertips. Sometimes when Victorian closed his hand, the skin would split and smoke. Yet the arm was stronger than it had ever been.
"Two guards are with me now," he told the dusky woman. "No foe can stand before two guards."
Then he rolled her on her back and took her once again. When the cliffs of Yaris appeared off their larboard bows, he found his three lost ships waiting for him, just as Makaro had promised. Victorian gave the priest a golden torch as a reward. Now he had a choice to make. Should he risk the straits or take the Iron Fleet around the island? The memory of Fair Isle still rankled in the Iron Captain's memory. Stannis Baratheon had descended on the Iron Fleet from both north and south, whilst they were trapped in the channel between the island and the mainland, dealing Victorian his most crushing defeat. But sailing around Yaris would cost him precious days. With Yunkai so near, shipping in the straits was like to be heavy, but he did not expect to encounter Yunkish warships until they were closer to Mirin. "What would the Crow's Eye do?" He brooded on that for a time, then signalled to his captains. "We sail the straits." Three more prizes were taken before Yaris dwindled off their sterns. A fat galleas fell to the Vole and Grief, and a trading galley to Manfred Merlin of Kite. Their holds were packed with trade goods, wines, and silks and spices, rare woods and rarer scents. But the ships themselves were the true prize. Later that same day, a fishing catch was taken by Seven Skulls and Thrall's Bane. She was a small, slow, dingy thing, hardly worth the effort of boarding. Victorian was displeased to hear that it had taken two of his own ships to bring the fisherman to heel. Yet it was from their lips that he heard of the Black Dragon's return. "The Silver Queen is gone," the catcher's master told him. "She flew away upon her dragon beyond the Dothraki Sea." "Where is this Dothraki Sea?" he demanded. "I will sail the armed fleet across it and find the queen wherever she may be." The fisherman laughed aloud. "That would be a sight worth seeing. The Dothraki Sea is made of grass, fool." He should not have said that. Victorian took him around the throat with his burned hand and lifted him bodily into the air. Slamming him back against the mast, he squeezed till the Yunkishman's face turned as black as the fingers digging into his flesh. The man kicked and writhed for a while, trying fruitlessly to pry loose the captain's grip. "No man calls Victorian Greyjoy a fool, and lives to boast of it." When he opened his hand, the man's limp body flopped to the deck. Longwater Pike and Tom Tidewood chucked it over the rail, another offering to the drowned god.
"Your drowned god is a demon,"
the black priest Makaro said afterwards.
"He's no more than a thrall of the other, the dark god whose name must not be spoken."
"Take care, priest," Victorian warned him. "There are godly men aboard this ship who would tear out your tongue for speaking such blasphemies. Your red god will have his due, I swear it. My word is iron. Ask any of my men."
The black priest bowed his head.
"There is no need. The Lord of Light has shown me your worth, Lord Captain. Every night in my fires I glimpse the glory that awaits you."
Those words pleased Victorian Greyjoy mightily, as he told the dusky woman that night.
"My brother Balin was a great man," he said, "but I shall do what he could not. The Iron Islands shall be free again, and the old way will return. Even Dagon could not do that."
Almost 100 years had passed since Dagon Greyjoy sat the sea stone chair, but the Ironborn still told tales of his raids and battles. In Dagon's day, a weak king sat the Iron Throne, his rheumy eyes fixed across the narrow sea where bastards and exiles plotted rebellion. So, forth from Pike, Lord Dagon sailed, to make the sunset sea his own. He bearded the lion in his den, and tied the direwolf's tail in knots. But even Dagon could not defeat the dragons. "But I shall make the Dragon Queen mine own. She will share my bed and bear me many mighty sons." That night the ships of the Iron Fleet numbered 60. Strange sails grew more common north of Yarrus. They were very near to Yunkai, and the coast between the Yellow City and Meereen would be teeming with merchantmen and supply ships coming and going. So Victorian took the Iron Fleet out into the deeper waters, beyond the sight of land. Even there they would encounter other vessels. "Let none escape to give warning to our foes," the Iron Captain commanded. None did. The sea was green and the sky was grey the morning Grief and Warrior Wench and Victorian's own Iron Victory captured the slaver galley from Yunkai in the waters due north of the Yellow City. In her holds were 20 perfumed boys and 40 girls destined for the pleasure houses of lice. Her crew never thought to find peril so close to their home waters, and the Ironborn had little trouble taking her. She was named the Willing Maiden. Victorian put the slavers to the sword, then sent his men below to unchain the rowers.
"You row for me now. Row hard, and you shall prosper."
The girls he divided amongst his captains.
"The Lyseni would have made whores of you," he told them, "but we have saved you. Now you need only serve one man instead of many. Those who please their captains may be taken as salt wives, an honorable station." The perfume boys he wrapped in chains and threw into the sea.
They were unnatural creatures, and the ship smelled better once cleansed of their presence. For himself, Victorian claimed the seven choicest girls. One had red gold hair and freckles on her teats. One shaved herself all over. One was brown-haired and brown-eyed, shy as a mouse. One had the biggest breasts he'd ever seen. The fifth was a little thing, with straight black hair and golden skin. Her eyes were the color of amber. The sixth was white as milk, with golden rings through her nipples and her nether lips. The seventh, black as a squid's ink. The slavers of Yunkai had trained them in the way of the seven sighs, but that was not why Victorian wanted them. His dusky woman was enough to satisfy his appetites until he could reach Meereen and claim his queen. No man had need of candles when the sun awaited him. The galley he renamed the Slaver's Scream. With her, the ships of the Iron Fleet numbered 160. "Every ship we capture makes us stronger," Victorian told his ironborn. "But from here it will grow harder. On the morrow or the day after, we are like to meet with more ships. We are entering the home waters of Meereen, where the fleets of our foes await us. We will meet with ships from all three slaver cities, ships from Tolos and Illyria and New Gis, even ships from Karth." He took care not to mention the green galleys of old Volantis, that surely must be sailing up through the Gulf of Grief, even as he spoke. "These slavers are feeble things. You have seen how they run before us, heard how they squeal when we put them to the sword. Every man of you is worth 20 of them, for only we are made of iron. Remember this. When first we next spy some slaver sails, give no quarter, and expect none. What need have we of quarter? We are the ironborn, and two gods look over us. We will seize their ships, smash their hopes, and turn their bay to blood." A great cry went up at his words. The captain answered with a nod, grim-faced, then called for the seven girls he had claimed to be brought on deck, the loveliest of all those found aboard the Willing Maiden. He kissed them each upon the cheeks and told them of the honour that awaited them, though they did not understand his words. Then he had them put aboard the fishing catch that they had captured, cut her loose, and had her set afire. "With this gift of innocence and beauty, we honour both the gods," he proclaimed, as the warships of the Iron Fleet rode past the burning catch. "Let these girls be reborn in light, undefiled by mortal lust, or let them descend to the drowned gods' watery halls, to feast and dance and laugh until the seas dry up." Near the end, before the smoking catch was swallowed by the sea, the cries of the seven sweetlings changed to joyous song, it seemed to Victorian Greyjoy. A great wind came up then, a wind that filled their sails and swept them north and east and north again, toward Meereen and its pyramids of many-colored bricks. "On wings of song I fly to you, Daenerys," the Iron Captain thought. That night, for the first time, he brought forth the dragon horn that the crow's eye had found amongst the smoking wastes of Great Valeria. A twisted thing it was, 6 feet long from end to end, gleaming black and banded with red gold and dark Valerian steel. "Euron's hail horn." Victorian ran his hand along it. The horn was as warm and smooth as a dusky woman's thighs, and so shiny that he could see a twisted likeness of his own features in its depths. Strange sorcerous writings had been cut into the bands that girded it. "Valerian glyphs," Makaro called them. That much Victorian had known. "What do they say?"
"Much and more."
The black priest pointed to one golden band.
"Here The horn is named. I am Dragon Binder, it says. Have you ever heard its sound?
Once. One of his brother's Mongols had sounded the hell horn at the king's moot, an old wick. A monster of a man he had been. Huge and shaven-headed, with rings of gold and jet and jade, around arms thick with muscle, and a great hawk tattooed across his chest. The sound it made, it burned somehow, as if my bones were on fire, searing my flesh from within. Those writings glowed red-hot, then white-hot, and painful to look upon. It seemed as if the sound would never end. It was like some lung scream, a thousand screams, all melted into one.
And the man who blew the horn, what of him?
He died. There were blisters on his lips after. His bird was bleeding, too. The captain thumped his chest. The hawk, just here. Every feather dripping blood. I heard the man was all burned up inside. But that might just have been some tale.
A true tale.
Makara turned the hell horn, examining the queer letters that crawled across a second of the golden bands.
Here it says, no mortal man shall sound me and live.
Bitterly, Victorian brooded on the treachery of brothers. Urine's gifts are always poisoned. The crows I swore this horn would bind dragons to my will. But how will that serve me, if the price is death?
Your brother did not sound the horn himself, nor must you.
Makoro pointed to the band of steel.
Here, blood for fire, fire for blood. Who blows the hell horn matters not. The dragons will come to the horn's master. You must claim the horn with blood.
The Ugly Little Girl. 11 servants of the many-faced god gathered that night beneath the temple, more than she had ever seen together at one time. Only the lordling and the fat fellow arrived by the front door. The rest came by secret ways, through tunnels and hidden passages. They wore their robes of black and white, but as they took their seats, each man pulled his cowl down to show the face he had chosen to wear that day. Their tall chairs were carved of ebony and weirwood, like the doors of the temple above. The ebon chairs had weirwood faces on their backs, the weirwood chairs faces of carved ebony. One of the other acolytes stood across the room with a flagon of dark red wine. She had the water. Whenever one of the servants wished to drink, he would raise his eyes or crook a finger, and one or both of them would come and fill his cup. But mostly they stood, waiting on looks that never came.
"I am carved of stone," she reminded herself. "I am a statue, like the sea lords that stand along the canal of the heroes."
The water was heavy, but her arms were strong. The priests used the language of Bravas, though once for several minutes three spoke heatedly in High Valyrian. The girl understood the words, mostly, but they spoke in soft voices, and she could not always hear.
"I know this man,"
she did hear a priest with the face of a plague victim say.
"I know this man,"
the fat fellow echoed, as she was pouring for him. But the handsome man said,
"I will give this man the gift. I know him not."
Later the squinter said the same thing of someone else. After 3 hours of wine and words, the priests took their leave, all but the kindly man, the waif, and the one whose face bore the marks of plague. His cheeks were covered with weeping sores, and his hair had fallen out. Blood dripped from one nostril and crusted at the corners of both eyes.
"Our brother would have words with you, child," the kindly man told her. "Sit, if you wish."
She seated herself in a weirwood chair, with a face of ebony. Bloody sores held no terror for her. She had been too long in the house of black and white to be afraid of a false face.
"Who are you?"
Plagueface asked when they were alone.
"No one."
"Not so you are. You have House Stark, who bites her lip and cannot tell a lie."
I was. I'm not now."
"Why are you here, liar?"
"To serve, to learn, to change my face."
"First change your heart. The gift of the many-faced gods is not a child's plaything. You would kill for your own purposes, for your own pleasures. Do you deny it?"
She bit her lip. He slapped her. The blow left her cheek stinging, but she knew that she had earned it.
"Thank you."
Enough slaps, and she might stop chewing on her lip. Arya did that, not the Night Wolf.
"I do deny it."
"You lie. I can see the truth in your eyes. You have the eyes of a wolf and a taste for blood."
"Sir Gregor,"
she could not help but think.
"Dunson, Wraith the Sweetling, Sir Ilion, Sir Merrin, Queen Cersei."
If she spoke, she would need to lie, and he would know. She kept silent.
"You were a cat, they tell me, prowling through the alleys, smelling of fish, selling cockles and mussels for coin. A small life, well suited to a small creature such as you. Ask, and it can be restored to you. Push your barrow, cry your cockles, be content. Your heart is too soft to be one of us."
"He means to send me away. I have no heart. I only have a hole. I've killed lots of people. I could kill you if I wanted."
"Would that taste sweet to you?"
She did not know the right answer.
"Maybe."
"Then you do not belong here. Death holds no sweetness in this house. We are not warriors, nor soldiers, nor swaggering bravos puffed up with pride. We do not kill to serve some lord, to fatten our purses, to stroke our vanity. We never give the gift to please ourselves, nor do we choose the ones we kill. We are but servants of the God of many faces."
"Valar Dohaeris, all men must serve."
"You know the words, but you're too proud to serve. A servant must be humble and obedient."
"I obey. I can be humbler than anyone."
That made him chuckle.
You will be the very goddess of humility, I'm sure. But can you pay the price?"
"What price?"
"The price is you. The price is all you have and all you ever hoped to have. We took your eyes and gave them back. Next we will take your ears, and you will walk in silence. You will give us your legs and crawl. You will be no one's daughter, no one's wife, no one's mother. Your name will be a lie, and the very face you wear will not be your own."
She almost bit her lip again, but this time she caught herself and stopped.
"My face is a dark pool, hiding everything, showing nothing."
She thought of all the names that she had worn. Ari, Weasel, Squab, Cat of the Canals. She thought of that stupid girl from Winterfell, called Arya Horseface. Names did not matter.
"I can pay the price. Give me a face."
"Faces must be earned."
"Tell me how."
"Give a certain man a certain gift. Can you do that?"
"What man?"
"No one that you know."
"I don't know a lot of people."
"He is one of them, a stranger. No one you love. No one you hate. No one you have ever known. Will you kill him?"
"Yes."
"Then on the morrow, you shall be Cat of the Canals again. Wear that face. Watch. Obey." and we will see if you are truly worthy to serve him of many faces."
So the next day she returned to Brusco and his daughters in the house on the canal. Brusco's eyes widened when he saw her, and Bria gave a little gasp.
"Vela Morgulis," Cat said, by way of greeting. "Vela Dalheris," Brusco replied.
After that, it was as if she'd never been away. She got her first look of the man she must kill later that morning, as she wheeled her barrow through the cobble streets that fronted on the Purple Harbour. He was an old man, well past 50.
"He has lived too long," she tried to tell herself. "Why should he have so many years when my father had so few?"
But Cat of the Canals had no father, so she kept that thought to herself.
"Cockles and mussels and clams,"
Cat cried as he went past.
"Oysters and prawns and fat green mussels."
She even smiled at him. Sometimes a smile was all you needed to make them stop and buy. The old man did not smile back. He scowled at her and went on past, sloshing through a puddle. The splash wet her feet.
"He has no courtesy," she thought, watching him go. "His face is hard and mean."
The old man's nose was pinched and sharp, his lips thin, his eyes small and close-set. His hair had gone to grey, but the little pointed beard at the end of his chin was still black. Cat thought it must be dyed, and wondered why he had not dyed his hair as well. One of his shoulders was higher than the other, giving him a crooked cast.
"He is an evil man," she announced that evening, when she returned to the house of Black and White. "His lips are cruel, his eyes are mean, and he has a villain's beard."
The kindly man chuckled. "He is a man like any other, with light in him and darkness. It is not for you to judge him." That gave her pause.
"Have the gods judged him?"
"Some gods, mayhaps. What are gods for, if not to sit in judgment over men? The many-faced God does not weigh men's souls, however. He gives his gift to the best of men as he gives it to the worst. Elsewise, the good would live forever." The old man's hands were the worst thing about him, Cat decided the next day, as she watched him from behind her barrow. His fingers were long and bony, always moving, scratching at his beard, tugging at an ear, drumming on a table, twitching, twitching, twitching.
"He has hands like two white spiders."
The more she watched his hands, the more she came to hate them.
"He moves his hands too much," she told them at the temple. "He must be full of fear. The gift will bring him peace."
"The gift brings all men peace."
"When I kill him, he will look in my eyes and thank me."
"If he does, you will have failed. It would be best if he takes no note of you at all." The old man was some sort of merchant, Cat concluded, after watching him for a few days. His trade had to do with the sea, though she never saw him set foot upon a ship. He spent his days sitting in a soup shop near the Purple Harbour, a cup of onion broth cooling at his elbow as he shuffled papers and sealing wax and spoke in sharp tones to a parade of captains, ship owners, and other merchants, none of whom seemed to like him very much. Yet they brought him money, leather purses plump with gold and silver, and the square iron coins of Bravas. The old man would count it out carefully, sorting the coins and stacking them up neatly, like with like. He never looked to the coins. Instead, he bit them, always on the left side of his mouth, where he still had all his teeth. From time to time, he'd spin one on the table and listen to the sound it made when it came clattering to a stop. And when all the coins had been counted and tasted, the old man would scrawl upon a parchment, stamp it with his seal, and give it to the captain. Else he'd shake his head and shove the coins back across the table. Whenever he did that, the other man would get red-faced and angry, or pale and scared-looking. Cat did not understand.
They pay him gold and silver, but he only gives them writing. Are they stupid?
A few, mayhaps. Most are simply cautious. Some think to cozen him. He's not a man easily cozened, however.
But what is he selling them?
He is writing each a binder. If their ships are lost in a storm or taken by pirates, he promises to pay them for the value of the vessel and all its contents.
Is it some kind of wager?
Of a sort. A wager every captain hopes to lose.
Yes, but if they win, they lose their ships.
Oftimes their very lives. The seas are dangerous, and never more so than in autumn. No doubt many a captain, sinking in a storm, has taken some small solace in his binder back in Braavos, knowing that his widow and children will not want. A sad smile touched his lips. It is one thing to write such a binder, though, and another to make good on it. Cat understood.
One of them must hate him. One of them came to the house of Black and White and prayed for the god to take him.
She wondered who it had been, but the kindly man would not tell her. It is not for you to pry into such matters, he said. Who are you?
No one.
No one asked no questions. He took her hands. If you cannot do this thing, you need only say so. There is no shame in that. Some are made to serve the many-faced God, and some are not. Say the word, and I shall lift this task from you.
I will do it. I said I would, I will.
How, though? That was harder. He had guards, two of them, a tall, thin man and a short, thick one. They went with him everywhere, from when he left his house in the morning till he returned at night. They made certain no one got close to the old man without his leave. Once a drunk almost staggered into him as he was coming home from the soup shop, but the tall one stepped between them and gave the man a sharp shove that knocked him to the ground. At the soup shop, the short one always tasted the onion broth first. The old man waited until the broth had cooled before he took a sip, long enough to be sure his guardsman had suffered no ill effects.
He's afraid, she realized, or else he knows that someone wants to kill him.
He does not know, said the kindly man, but he suspects.
The guards go with him, even when he slips out to make water, she said, but he doesn't go when they do. The tall one is the quicker. I'll wait until he's making water, walk into the soup shop, and stab the old man through the eye.
And the other guard?
He's slow and stupid. I can kill him too.
Are you some butcher of the battlefield, hacking down every man who stands in your way?
No.
I would hope not. You are a servant of the many-faced god. And we who serve him of many faces give his gift only to those who have been marked and chosen. She understood.
Kill him! Kill only him!
It took her three more days of watching before she found the way, and another day of practicing with her finger knife. Red Rogo had taught her how to use it, but she had not slit a purse since back before they took away her eyes. She wanted to make certain that she still knew how.
Smooth and quick. That's the way. No fumbling, she told herself,
and she slipped the little blade out of her sleeve, again and again and again. When she was satisfied that she still remembered how to do it, she sharpened the steel on a whetstone until its edge glimmered silver-blue in the candlelight. The other part was trickier, but the waif was there to help her.
I will give the man the gift on the morrow,
she announced as she was breaking her fast.
Him of many faces will be pleased,
the kindly man rose.
Cat of the canals is known to many. If she is seen to have done this deed, it might bring down trouble on Brusco and his daughters. It is time you had another face.
The girl did not smile, but inside she was pleased. She had lost Cat once and mourned her. She did not want to lose her again.
"What would I look like?"
"Ugly. Women will look away when they see you. Children will stare and point. Strong men will pity you, and some may shed a tear. No one who sees you will soon forget you. Come."
The kindly man took the iron lantern off its hook and led her past the still black pool and the rows of dark and silent gods to the steps at the rear of the temple. The waif fell in behind them as they were making their descent. No one spoke. The soft scuff of slippered feet on the steps was the only sound. 18 steps brought them to the vaults, where 5 arched passageways spread out like the fingers of a man's hand. Down here, the steps grew narrower and steeper, but the girl had run up and down them 1,000 times, and they held no terrors for her. 22 more steps, and they were at the sub-cellar. The tunnels here were cramped and crooked, black wormholes twisting through the heart of the great rock. One passage was closed off by a heavy iron door. The priest hung the lantern from a hook, slipped a hand inside his robe, and produced an ornate key. Goose prickles rose along her arms.
The sanctum.
They were going lower still, down to the third level, to the secret chambers where only the priests were permitted. The key clicked 3 times, very softly, as the kindly man turned it in a lock. The door swung open on oiled iron hinges, making not a sound. Beyond were still more steps, hewn out of solid rock. The priest took down the lantern once again and led the way. The girl followed the light, counting the steps as she went down. 4, 5, 6, 7. She found herself wishing that she had brought her stick. 10, 11, 12. She knew how many steps there were between the temple and the cellar, between the cellar and the sub-cellar. She had even counted the steps on the cramped, winding stair that spiraled up into the garret, and the rungs on the steep wooden ladder that ascended to the roofed-up door and the windy perch outside. This stair was unknown to her, however, and that made it perilous. 1 and 20, 2 and 20, 3 and 20. With every step the air seemed to grow a little colder. When her count reached 30, she knew that they were under even the canals. 3 and 30, 4 and 30. How deep were they going to go? She had reached 54 when the steps finally ended at another iron door. This one was unlocked. The kindly man pushed it open and stepped through. She followed, with a waif on her heels. Their footsteps echoed through the darkness. The kindly man lifted his lantern and flicked its shutter wide open. Light washed over the walls around them. 1,000 faces were gazing down on her. They hung upon the walls, before her and behind her, high and low, everywhere she looked, everywhere she turned. She saw old faces and young faces, pale faces and dark faces, smooth faces and wrinkled faces, freckled faces and scarred faces, handsome faces and homely faces, men and women, boys and girls, even babes, smiling faces, frowning faces, faces full of greed and rage and lust, bald faces and faces bristling with hair.
"Masks," she told herself, "it's only masks."
But even as she thought the thought, she knew it wasn't so. They were skins.
"Do they frighten you, child?" asked the kindly man. "It is not too late for you to leave us. Is this truly what you want?"
Arya bit her lip. She did not know what she wanted.
"If I leave, where will I go?"
She had washed and stripped 100 corpses. Dead things did not frighten her.
"They carry them down here and slice their faces off. So what?"
She was a night wolf. No scraps of skin could frighten her.
"Leather hoods, that's all they are. They cannot hurt me." do it," she blurted out. He led her across the chamber, past a row of tunnels leading off into side passages.